The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
School of Humans.
This is like being a washerwoman, right? Not my most favorite thing to do. A little bit of skill, though, because you don't want to scratch anything. So how many strokes did the guy hit the lady with?
One or two.
One or two? Yeah, you probably hurt somebody pretty bad. You get a good swing with one of those legs, I bet. Wish I had one.
You could get a good swing with one of those legs, he said. That was an understatement. We know that it was a piano leg that is suspected to be the murder weapon. According to my source, that piano leg was never found. So we're in a piano repair shop, looking to learn anything we can that might help solve the case that haunts us all. In September of 2004, 22-year-old Rebecca Gould was brutally murdered in a remote area of the Arkansas Ozarks. 14 years later, her killer is still out there. I've come back to Mountain View with one mission: to get justice for Rebecca. I'm Katherine Townsend, and this is Hell and Gone.
Narrowing it down in my old age.
The piano repair shop feels a little bit like a junkyard, but with fancy pianos. There's instruments everywhere. If we're going to find out what kind of piano leg killed Rebecca Gould, this is the place.
So I was wondering if, you know, we just could take a look at some of the, you know, these piano legs here, just the different types.
Carpenter 7, I'll turn on the light over there.
Okay.
Rick Cooley is the shop owner. He's been working with pianos for 45 years, so he knows what he's doing. But I think we're the first people to ask him so many questions about piano legs.
They just don't come off normally. You know, they come off if you have to get them off, but they're not made to come off particularly. And if upright, nobody's going to certainly get the leg off of it.
Yes.
There's no way to get it off. It's screwed to the toe. Yeah. So it has to be a free leg. But most of them just have a bolt down the middle and just screw in there.
And the French leg, that's the one on the left where it's more like curved.
It probably
and
has a couple of screws. It'd be hard to screw that one on. It might. Some of them do, but most of them just have like a bolt that's glued into the leg and just screws on.
I can see because they kind of stick out. So if something were to like hit it on the bottom, it would probably
see that one's kind of loose. It screws on. but I'm not going to take it off unless you want to go buy me a six-pack of beer or something.
Well, I guess I might break one off, or sometimes they're falling off, you know? Sometimes the screw's stripped out or something.
Does that happen a lot?
I mean, who knows when somebody moves one and beats one up and they lived in a trailer, it probably gets pretty beat up.
No, I mean, I imagine it's because it's a tight...
If it was in somebody's ranch quarters. House living room, it probably wouldn't be beat up, but in a trailer, it probably wouldn't be. So, console with a spinet has a free leg, usually. That's the console. It's a little taller. That's the spinet.
So that's the...
Most pianos don't have a free leg once they get to be bigger.
Consoles and spinets.
Yeah, spinet's the smaller one, but that's the only two. I said that those kind of legs are common to spinets and consoles that are verticals. They're all verticals, you know, but old ones are big things like that.
I see. They have more of like a top to them.
Right. And they're more, that's the old fashioned. Yeah.
And how much did you think that a leg like that weighs, like 2-3 pounds or?
My gosh, like 4 pounds or something maybe. I mean, it's wood. It couldn't be that heavy.
A baseball is ash, which is a harder wood than most piano wood would be. So I'm sure a baseball bat probably weighs, and a little bit longer, a baseball bat, it probably weighs a little more than a piano leg. Piano leg was going to be made out of just something like birch or maple or something, probably.
I had a loose one, I'd let you heft it, but I don't. I don't even have anything similar.
Not bigger, but sounds bigger.
After visiting the shop, I feel like we have a clear sense of the suspected murder weapon. The piano in Casey's house was either a console or spinet piano, the smaller kind that can fit up against a wall and would fit in a tiny trailer. The legs for these pianos are mostly straight and decorative, and in cheaper models, they just have one screw that connects the leg. Basically, the legs look like upside-down baseball bats. They're thin, and they weigh around 3 to 4 pounds. Light enough to pick up and swing. Heavy enough to kill someone. Right now, we're looking for Chris, a former drug dealer who's been in and out of jail his whole life. He's rumored to be the cop's number one suspect in the murder. A police source told me that their working theory is that Chris was allegedly high on drugs and he did it because Rebecca rejected his sexual advances. I've met Chris before. I visited him in jail several years ago. He was very cooperative and kind to me back then, but everyone keeps warning me that he's a dangerous guy. Plus, his background and the unpredictability of drugs in general make this a scary situation. Finding him won't be easy, but it's what we have to do next. While we search for him, we need to follow the evidence and see if it supports this theory. Since we aren't going to be getting the case file, we'll have to find it ourselves. Fortunately, we were able to get the autopsy report from Rebecca's dad, Larry, along with a lot of other independent medical analysis and research he's commissioned over the years. We meet up with George Jared to discuss the autopsy. Because of his reporting about Rebecca, George has become close to Rebecca's dad, Larry, and he's turning out to be a valuable member of our investigative team as well.
You realize that every day there's at least probably a person who walks through that door who has flat out killed somebody in cold blood. Nobody knows who they are.
100%.
And they're smiling at you, talking to you, acting like nothing happened.
It's just really surreal that they're out and walking around.
What's frustrating about this case is if we could just get some basic information, I mean, you know, like the police to verify the piano leg theory. I mean, you know, we know it's probably true. I mean, someone told Dr. Gould, because if you look at the autopsy report, she died from one or two blows to the head. Dr. Gould told me it was from a piano leg. Somebody was really mad, and they hit her with enough force to kill her in one or two blows, which even with a piano leg, it would take a lot of power to do it, even for a grown man. And, you know, you can hit somebody in the head with something and not kill them. And so to do it, it must have been very anger-fueled. Her actual death report, I guess, it actually says only one blow. Dr. Gould said he thinks there's two. Because there was like a rendering of her skull, and there was like some damage to another part of it, and he thought it was another... another hit, but you know, technically she was hit one time, and that was the death blow. That is what actually ended up killing her.
The autopsy reads as a cold document, but it still gives me chills. It's almost like I'm back in the morgue, watching the details of Rebecca's murder get poked and prodded by the medical examiner, weighed out with precision, written out in terse prose.
This 22-year-old white female, Rebecca Gould, died of blunt force injuries of the head. According to investigation, she was last independently known alive on Monday, September 27th. By the way, that's not right. It's the 20th. That's a mistake. At the time of her disappearance, she was staying at a friend's residence near Melbourne, Arkansas. She was reported missing on September 21st. On September 27th, her body was discovered in a ravine along State Highway 9, south of Melbourne. Death was officially pronounced at 10:54 a.m. Identification of the deceased was established through dental records. A relatively high degree of decomposition change was noted. In general, this was consistent with death having taken place at or around the time of her disappearance. It was further noted that the amount of decomposition involving the head was disproportionately advanced compared to most of the rest of the body. Overall examination of the body did not reveal any evidence of penetrating trauma. There was no evidence of significant blunt force injury involving the thorax. An assessment for the presence or absence of trauma related to sexual assault could not be performed due to the advanced degree of decomposition present. In light of the suspicious nature of her disappearance, findings at the scene, and the nature of her injuries, the manner of death is homicide. So yeah, it was a really, really, really hard hit to the head.
Jeez.
Maybe twice. It looks like the one super hard hit to the temple was something like the piano leg, because it cracked her skull. That was the one that cracked her skull.
I noticed the name at the bottom of the autopsy, Frank Peretti. He's the medical examiner for the Arkansas State Police. And he's actually a bit of a controversial figure because he also oversaw the medical examination of the infamous West Memphis 3 case. Larry also paid to have an independent review done. It confirms a lot of the details of the autopsy, but also has some additional insights. Larry told us that Dennis said Rebecca had been sexually assaulted, but the autopsy specifically said that certain medical tests could not be performed due to the length of time that the body had been exposed to the elements. Also, Rebecca was wearing her underwear and t-shirt that, according to Danielle, she often wore to bed. Would a rapist attack someone and then put their underwear back on, but not bother to redress them? According to friends and family, Rebecca was a spitfire who would not back down from a fight. Reading the autopsy, it looks like Rebecca did not have defensive wounds. The autopsy mentions that material was taken from under her fingernails. The evidence suggests that she was not afraid of her killer. The date on the autopsy is wrong, but that's most likely a typo. So we have a murder weapon and an autopsy report that says Rebecca died from one or two blows to the head. But to make sure we're leaving no stone unturned, we call a neurologist to get their take.
Taylor?
Hey, yeah, that's me.
Hey.
Hi.
Adam Webb.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. To the left, and we can do one of a couple of things. Let's see if this should be good in here. Any blunt trauma to the head can be dangerous. Typically, when we think about the sort of severe trauma to the head that ends people's lives, we're thinking about bad falls or car accidents or anything like that. And usually those types of things cause severe injury to the whole brain at the same time, sort of diffuse injury to the brain from deceleration and rocking around in the skull. However, other blunt force trauma can certainly cause injury significant enough to cause death. Trauma with a piano leg or any sort of, you know, blunt instrument could cause bleeding on the outside of the brain, either what's called an epidural hematoma or a subdural hematoma. And those can put pressure on the brain and certainly could cause death if not recognized in a short period of time. So certainly if it caused that much soft tissue damage and caused a skull fracture or, you know, a fracture of any of the facial bones or anatomy, that certainly could be enough to cause death.
And are there certain parts of the head that may be more susceptible than others? So like if she was maybe hit like on the top of the head as opposed to like down by the jaw?
So in the temple region is one area that is susceptible. There's an artery there called the middle meningeal artery that if ruptured can cause severe bleeding on the outside of the brain. And so that is one area, especially in a younger person where damage that caused a skull fracture could lead to death.
I mean, that would be the quickest, easiest, like least amount of force.
The two areas, I mean, that would be one. The other would be at the base of the base of the skull, where you can do damage to breathing structures and the and the cervical spinal cord and the arteries that the vertebral arteries that supply blood to the base of the brain. And so that's another area that if damaged could cause significant injury pretty quickly.
So it sounds like there was internal bleeding, but what about all the blood at the crime scene?
So usually when we see blood on the outside of the body, that would indicate that someone's bleeding from an external source. And so there are a number of arteries in the face and neck area that if someone was bleeding outwardly, they could lose a significant amount of blood. That brings up another possibility, which is that that it wasn't the brain injury at all. And that's, if there was a significant amount of blood, someone could simply, lose enough blood volume to not be able to circulate blood to their organs.
Adam opens a nearby textbook and rifles to images of brain injuries consistent with Rebecca's.
Yeah. So this is a scan of something called an epidural hematoma. And what I'm looking at here is this, you can see there's like a lens-shaped area that's not, you don't see it on this side. And so it sort of bulges out right there. And so what happens is that's a hemorrhage that occurs between the skull and one of the outer layers of the outer coverings of the brain called the dura. And that's one that's oftentimes, if you have a fracture that goes through the middle meningeal artery, which runs sort of in the temple, region, that's something that you could see.
After talking with Adam, it's clear that it is possible to cause enough damage to kill someone with one blow. And surprisingly, it may not have required a significant amount of force. But the thing that really bugs me about the autopsy is the decomposition of the body and how that relates to the timeline of death. We head out to the spot on Highway 9 where Rebecca's body was found. Hopefully that will give us some context.
There's a bone. Look, there's a skeleton. See, look, and once you get over there, it gets really steep. So this area right here is a really hilly, remote area. It's near actually a scenic, like, beauty area overlook. It's near a lot of national forest land. You look down over, like, this. So from the road, there's all this kind of brush and trees and, yeah, and then you go past that and there's this huge rocky drop-off.
And do you know, was it on this first drop-off or was it on this much steeper, lower?
I thought it was on the first drop-off because a lot of people said you could see it from the road, but this would be a perfect dump area, actually. I still think it would have been a much better plan, actually, to bury a body in the woods rather than just like, because you know it's going to get discovered if you throw it. I mean, yeah, it might take a while, but like, it's going to get discovered.
That's what I wonder, too, if there was something that just like spooked them. They were just kind of waiting, hoping to find a better spot. And then eventually they were just like, we need to get rid of this now. Pulled up on the side of the road and then disposed of the body.
I think so. I mean, I think there's a really good chance that it was not here for a week, that it was somewhere else. It's funny, though, like when I first heard about this, like before I first came here, they did make it seem, they're like, oh, it was, visible from the road. And as you can see, like, not necessarily. There's a lot of really wild growth and trees and, I can see where it would stay hidden.
Rebecca's body was found close to the road beside a scenic overlook. It's one of the only places on the curvy, steep road with a shoulder where people can actually pull over to check out the views or to dump trash.
I'm torn about that because I feel like on the one hand,
I can totally see how a body could stay hidden down there for a week, you know, with my limited. On the other hand, there were hundreds of people looking, and like you said, if it's an obvious garbage drop area, wouldn't this be like one of the very first places they searched?
But some lingering questions remain for me. Was Rebecca dumped here immediately after she died? Or was she kept somewhere else and then moved? I remember hearing from several first responders that they saw buzzards circling the site where Rebecca's body was found. Maybe that's a clue as to when Rebecca's body was actually dumped at the Highway 9 site. So we contact Keith Bildstein, a conservation scientist who knows a ton about vultures.
I have been into the northern part of Arkansas, but I have been into the southern part of Missouri, and that's gorgeous hill country. Two vultures that occur in that part of the country. One is a black vulture, which hunts entirely by sight and not by smell. And the other is the turkey vulture, which uses both olfaction and vision to locate carcasses. Vultures can be pretty persnickety when a new kind of carcass occurs in a new area. If it's a typical kind of carcass, like the deer, the vultures would be more likely to go to something that they're familiar with, that doesn't look out of place, that doesn't look strange, that looks more normal. If the carcass was unopened, you know, the human carcass, it might take a little bit longer for the vultures to locate it. The question that you have to ask yourself is not the carcass you're thinking of, but how many other carcasses might have been around for the vultures to feed on, because they don't like really old meat unless there's no alternative.
Over the last few days, as we've been investigating the facts of the autopsy report, I've been pulling out all the stops to try to find Chris. But in a town where everyone seems to be afraid of him, that's not always easy. I've made inroads with a local source who is scared of us even using their voice. And they've just given me a lead. During the weekends, Chris has been visiting his girlfriend, Cindy. But during the week, he's at a rehab facility in Bee Branch, Arkansas. And if that's where he is, then that's where we're headed.
Avenue. We are literally driving into the middle of mess storm territory right now.
We're driving straight through the heart of the part of Arkansas where the documentary Meth Storm was filmed. This part of Arkansas has been decimated by poverty and meth.
This is some creepy shit right here.
Yeah, it is.
Look at that.
That trailer.
Oh, God. Do you think somebody lives there?
Turn left onto Sam.
This is meth land, dude. I'm telling you.
Ew, look at that. Look in there. There's like a tree.
Look to it's the like, right. Look to the right. Look.
Oh, my God.
This is a broken
what
down.
What is that?
9 miles.
I don't know.
Turn left onto Highway 65 North.
Oh, no. We're getting the hell out of here.
The deeper we get, the scarier it gets. And the more I hope my grandmother's 20-year-old Durango does not break down.
Okay. If he is at this rehab facility, I feel like we have a better chance.
He might not recognize me, but once I say, oh, hey, I'm Carolyn's sister, remember I came and saw you in jail, he'll know.
I mean, how many people have visited
right.
him in jail?
He'll know who I am once I say that. I did read the contract with this one rehab that's in Bee Branch, and it sort of said that they were expected to get jobs in the community and to, you know, work, and it had this list of kind of like rules you follow, but it didn't sound like it was inpatient. You know what I mean? It sounded more like maybe something that you could leave on the weekends.
Okay, so that was my question. You answered my question then. Like, could we be at the right place, but he is at work?
But at this point, we don't really know. We're not sure of his exact address. We have this piece of information. So it's either, we have really two options now because we don't know any of his friends. It's like either we try to go here and get him by himself and have a shot at that, or we have to try and get to him through Cindy. And I feel like that's really hit or miss. So I think this is, unfortunately, like, this is probably the best option to try this. Because if it worked, it would be much better than having to try and figure out what day he's going to be in Mountain View, maybe, or try to get to him through Cindy.
Absolutely.
this guy, nobody seems to know where he is. Even his people are supposed to be his friends.
Right.
I brought along a letter I wrote to Chris so that if we can't ambush him, we've still communicated with him and let him know we're not a threat.
Like, can we leave this letter for him? But we don't want to leave it if this is not
it's
the right place.
It's coming up right
yes, up here. Shit, man.
Destination is on your right.
This place is scary as hell.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, God damn it, that's him. I'm going to go over here.
Yeah, it's fine.
Hello? Hey, how's it going?
The phone rings. It's my source.
We're actually in B Branch right now, just looking for Chris. Oh, God. Oh, my God, are you in Mountain View? He's back in Mountain View. No, like, he's at Cindy's right now working on a truck. He's outside right now. Oh, my God, this is killing me. How long till we're back to Mountain View? 2:15. I just really want to get him if we can. This might be our only shot.
He says he's sitting outside a house where Chris's car is right now. The GPS says we're a half hour away. I can drive it in 15. We'll be right back.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on. Get ready for a ride. We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites.
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source, and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into what lies beneath the glitzy image of Hollywood's golden age and all the sex, money, and murder that's been swept under the rug for decades. Using the Variety archives, each episode offers a rare glimpse into little-known casting couch stories that have long lived in the shadows. So join us as we navigate the tangled web of Hollywood's secret history with host Tracy Patton, along with expert Variety reporters and correspondents, as they discuss the secret history of the casting couch to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
when people say, oh, find this person, it's not just like, oh, you put something in a database and it spits out an address. It's really hard. It involves, and you don't have it confirmed until you physically are staking them out and seeing them at that place. And even then, you know, it could be different the next day. I'm like, and of course, it's fucking so slow.
Getting closer, we realize that this is about the spot where they lost Cindy on the stakeout.
How we passed it a million times then.
That is so nuts. I knew it. I knew she had to be right off of the road somehow because there's no way.
She's disappeared.
She just literally vanished. We got all the way back to like the one light in town and I was like, she's gone.
In a quarter mile, your destination will be on the right.
There it is right there, right? There's a white car.
That's it.
That's it. I don't see my outside.
That's it. Cause
that's a white car.
That's your destination is on the right. Holy
shit, unless that's it, because that also could be it. That's him.
That's him?
The source has given us the road, but there's two houses it could be. And if we mess this up, we've just tipped the neighbors off that we're looking for him. We need to be 100% sure before we pull into this driveway.
It's the second one. It's the one with the people out front.
Let's go. Oh, stop right in front of me.
There's two guys out there.
You ready?
Yep.
Take a deep breath, dude.
You get my
ready?
Yep.
Chris.
Hey.
Chris is not that tall, but he's strong in stature. This is clearly a guy who has been through a lot in his life. His hands are coated in oil from working on his car, but the thing that strikes me most are his eyes. They're very light blue, almost glass-like. He has a look of concern, like a friend asking for help. He looks surprised to see me, but he knew exactly who I was. He tells us he'll talk, but he invites us inside his house. My strategy when talking to anyone is to keep an open mind and not to judge. I think that they can sense that I'm straight with them, and that's why so many people are comfortable telling me their darkest secrets. It's clear that this case isn't just about the good guys and the bad guys. There are several shades of gray. Chris knows why I'm here and what I want to know. I've already asked him straight out if he killed Rebecca. Now that he's not being recorded by the cops, I want to know if he'll tell me why he doesn't trust them.
Well, so like I said, we've been working on this for a long time, and we've always been convinced that the cops are just totally incompetent, and
that's a big word for me, incompetent or incompetent.
I think that since the beginning, I've never thought that you had anything to do with it, and Nick and I talked a lot, and he never thought you had anything to do with it, and the police just seem super focused on that, and so, we're just really trying to find out, like, first of all, there's all these weird rumors, like, that weekend. Do you have any idea, like, why they thought you were involved?
Yeah, at the time, like, my opinion, at the time, like, I was at a friend's house, and he lived on Herple. Well, Rebecca had stopped by there that night. Well, he had said something out of the sidelines, like he was supposed to go fix her car the next morning. Well, that's the morning she came up missing or whatever. And then, like, I told the cops that or whatever, and then it turned around. So they started trying to, well, you know her whereabouts or whatever. You know what I mean? I'm like, well, you know, Daniel and Nick, Rebecca, me, all of us went to school together, and I was really, really friends with them, you know what I mean? So, like, I felt like, and Tim Mary had kind of docked me because I had a bad influence environment that I lived in when I was a kid. And they'd asked me, you know, and I said, yeah, Mom, like, you know, Rebecca stopped by JB's house and that night or whatever, and he's supposed to go fix your car the next morning. And JB come up out of town for like 2 or 3 days, was gone. He said he was at some kind of appointment or something. But I felt like when he looked at me like just empty eyes, you know what I mean? Of course, we was all under the influence of drugs and stuff back then, like really heavy. But in my heart, my opinion, I always thought he knew something more than what he was saying or he had done it. And so he was supposed to go over and fix his car the next day. You know, like, did you fix your car? And he wouldn't answer me, you know what I mean? Like, and so I always thought that, you know, he either brought some people down from Cabot that did it or he knew more about it than what he was explaining. And I, like, the more I kind of, you know, tried to help solve the case, the more it got pushed on me that I had done it. After that case right there, it kind of learned me the hard way is never to, you know, I put myself in it as a suspect, basically, you know what I mean? And the only reason I even cared because Rebecca, we always raised in school together, you know what I mean? And, like, Rebecca and Danielle would always stay at Nick and Danielle's house. I mean, Nick was dating Danielle.
Right.
So we was always real close. Even like Rebecca and Danielle stayed at the gas station, but Tim and Mary owned it up there. And like we was always real close together, you know what I mean? So in my opinion, I watched a lot of stuff, but like the last person that seen that person was JB. In my heart, I know that for a fact. So why don't you go to him and ask him?
Well, what night was this when that all...
It's been a long time ago. It was that night Rebecca stopped by there and got some weed ordered from JB. And then JB said, yeah, I'll come over and fix your car the next day over there. Well, he came up missing 2 or 3 days after that. Well, why don't you go ask him, you know, instead of pushing down my throat that I done it, why don't the cops go ask him?
I mean, had you ever been to that house?
At that point in time, I didn't know that, and I had never been to that house before. So that's why I told Janet Simon, I said, there's no way you can pin this on me. If you put me on a lot of tests, because I've never been over there.
Yeah.
You know, ever. And I met Casey one time, and he was at the gas station. And I knew that something about Sonic. That's all I know about Casey at that point in time.
Right.
You know, so I've never been over there.
Did they ever ask where you were on Sunday and Monday?
That night or whatever, I went to Tim and Mary's house. And that next morning when I woke up, she asked me, she said, have you seen Rebecca?
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I heard that she stopped by JB's house last night. And that's what threw the cops over at me. But I said, I'll go over there to JB's house today and ask, you know. JB's been gone, you know, all day, and I haven't seen him. And then I come back by there, you know what I mean, and still no JB. And it was like 2 days JB was gone. But he had an alibi because he went to some appointment. So I don't know what, maybe he did have, you know, I don't know. You know,
right.
Because I wasn't, you know, wasn't with him or nothing, but that's all I knew about it. But I was like, man, you know, in my heart, JB, you know, and you said it out of your mouth that you was going to go over and fix your car, you know what I mean? And this time he felt like I was trying to pin him for it, you know what I mean? I was like, well, you know, in my heart, I think you had something to do with it, JB. And I mean, if I ever found out that, I mean, I'd hurt you, you know? And I was like, you know, because that was like my sister, and I mean, nobody deserves something like that, you know?
That's horrible. So you guys are close, right? I mean, you and Rebecca.
Yeah, and Danielle, like, we went just, like, all the way from, I think, first grade all the way until, like, she passed away. Like, and we was all pretty close, you know what I mean? And you know how it is in school, you know? We went to pep rallies and stuff like that. So they would also come to Tim and Mary's house a lot, and they'd also go to church with us all. Tim and Mary kind of adopted, like, all of us as a family, you know? So, yeah, I was really close to that whole family.
Tim and Mary were Chris's adopted parents. They were also Danielle's ex-husband Nick's biological parents. So there really was a close connection between Chris, Danielle, and Rebecca. She was like a sister to him.
At one point in time, like, I didn't have no place to stay when I first met Rebecca and Danielle and Joan. And they had a van sitting out in the front yard. And, like, she would leave the van unlocked and let me sleep in it because I had no place to sleep. Somebody all opening the doors for me, it was just a van, but to me, it was a home, you know what I mean? And I'd always go there after school and stuff, especially on ball games, and I'd sleep in that van, you know? And sometimes she'd let me come in the house, take showers. And I kept my clothes in that van and stuff for, like, years. She was a good person, and she had a good heart, you know, and, like, I just didn't... And that's how I always kind of cooperated, you know what I mean? Because, like, anything that I might hold in my mind, I wanted to let it out, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, unforgiveness, you know, and, like, I didn't want to... And guilt and shame, you know, about, you know, if I would have actually, you know, done something, you know, if I'd known that was going to happen and stuff like that, you know, it was weighed heavy on me for a long time. But, I mean, I finally just, you know, told the Lord, like, you know, please take his burden from me, you know, and, like, you know, just let me be able to accept what had happened, you know, and just go on with my life because, you know, I'm getting older and I have family and kids and stuff. But, like, I'd always cooperated with Dennis Simon, anybody that's always come and ask me, you know. But, you know, that's what I told Dennis Simon. I was like, well, you know, you can do whatever to me, but I've never been over there, so you can't, in a way, you can stick me for it, you know what I mean? And I was like, I mean, I tell you whatever I know. And the more I told him, the more I feel like I was a suspect. So I just... He wanted the DNA sample and stuff, and I was like, look, dude, I'll give you a DNA sample, but I'm not giving it to you. I even got on a lie detector test one time, and, like, I flunked every question. And I felt like he was trying to manipulate me into saying something that I didn't. And I'm like, dude, you know, I'm just done at this point in time, you know. Like, I don't, you know, I think I even flunked my own name. I'm like, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I flunked every question. Like, I was just lying about everything. And I'm like, you know, I've told you everything, so... They don't even like me at all, period. You know, and I pray every day that they actually catch the person who did it. But in my heart, I feel like they already know the person who did it and they're never actually going to, you know.
Thanks, Chris.
You all have a good one.
Did you see his eyes? He had tears in his eyes. This is the guy that everybody's been saying is like the you know, this evil, whatever. His eyes were all tearing up. I thought he was going to cry.
I mean, it honestly sounded like he genuinely wanted the thing solved and like wanted.
Well, otherwise, why the fuck would he talk to us? He took us in there and like answered questions and was like, you know, what we've heard from everybody is that at the time, he even said, I said, well, what day was this? He can't quite remember the days. I just feel strongly, maybe, you know, everybody's fudging a little. JB might even be fudging about how close, but although no, he said it was a couple nights. It was that weekend. Chris and JB's stories fit together. Do you know what I mean? They do. Yeah. They fit perfect. And he even said, I thought it was him. I said, and JB's like, he thought it was me. And that's why I got pissed off and wanted to kick his ass.
We get back to the car, and Taylor and I are still shaking. We either just met with a murderer or someone who has been wrongly accused of murder. We'll be right back.
Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on, get ready for a ride. We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites!
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way!
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear!
What did we learn today?
Hey, it's so cool!
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source, and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into what lies beneath the glitzy image of Hollywood's golden age and all the sex, money, and murder that's been swept under the rug for decades. Using the Variety archives, each episode offers a rare glimpse into little-known casting couch stories that have long lived in the shadows. So join us as we navigate the tangled web of Hollywood's secret history with host Tracy Patton, along with expert Variety reporters and correspondents, as they discuss the secret history of the casting couch to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
She's breathing right now?
Yes, she's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation.
I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After speaking with Chris, we head back to the house and meet George Jared to go over the murder board and unpack what Chris told us. So let's say this theory is correct, that Chris killed Rebecca while he was on some crazy drug rage and upset about Rebecca denying his sexual advances. Was there anything in the autopsy report to indicate that this could have been a meth murder?
Dr. Gould and I have actually gone back and forth on this particular detail. There is no indication she was sexually assaulted. You gotta remember, it's 2004. It's, you know, like DNA testing, stuff like that. The techniques for collecting DNA, not as advanced as they are, obviously, today. The decomposition factor, it was late September, and I remember vividly it was very hot during that time period, so that the decomposition would have been more rapid. Now, Dr. Gould seems to think it's still a possibility that she may have been sexually assaulted, and she may have been. I mean, he obviously knows more about the human body than I do, but I just got, you know, this is kind of the way I operate. Let's just operate from facts. And and as of right now, there is no evidence of it, so I can't assume that it happened.
And it could also just, I think, for the simple fact that if you are on meth, I mean, it can make you, the crimes I've seen that have been committed while people are on meth are just like, something out of a horror movie, you know? Oh. It takes it to another level.
The story you're about to hear is horrific. If you're easily disturbed, I recommend you skip ahead a minute and a half.
Back in 1998, there was a family of four in Dalton. A friend is having car trouble. The father gets up, he's a pretty good mechanic. He goes with his friend down to the river. Within a few minutes, he's shot in the head twice, thrown in the river. The killer comes back to the house. The little boy comes running up to the door. The killer has a tire tool in his hand. He crushes that kid's head like an eggshell. The mom comes running in to try to stop him, and he hits her 27 times with his tire tool. 27 times. Then he goes into the room where the little girl's hiding under her bed. He drops the tire tool in her stuffed animals. He pulls her out from under the bed, wraps her in a blanket, and throws her in the back of a car. As the killer's getting ready to leave, he notices something moving through the yard in the dark. It's the mom. She woke up and she climbed out the kitchen window, and her parents lived next door. She was trying to get to their house. And when she did, she got all the way to their front door on their porch. There's a bloody handprint on the door. Her killer came up behind her, slashed her throat from end to end.
It's horrible.
And the guy that did that, and I go through that whole theory, high on meth.
Yeah, it makes people insane.
Her murder is not, any murder shocking, but it's not like the story I just told you about what happened to the Elliott family. That is grotesque. I mean, you hear a story like that and you're like, oh my God. And you won't stop thinking about it. What happened to her is she got hit in the head a couple times and her body was dumped on the side of the road. It's not a profoundly heinous crime, I guess is what I'm trying to. She wasn't, as far as we know, she wasn't brutally sexually assaulted. So to me, it's one of these crimes, okay, there's not a lot of complicated moving parts here. Like that case, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of dead people and missing people, and this is a whole thing. So in her case, it's not like that.
Right now, I believe Chris, which means we have to go back and get everyone's stories on our own, explore all the possible suspects, until we find the theory that sticks and we can bring Rebecca's killer to justice.
So, you've talked to JB already. I mean, do you think he had anything to do with it?
No, I've ruled him out. I mean, I'm following the evidence. I really, in my mind, he's been ruled out because for several reasons. I mean, number one, he was in Cabot that weekend. His story makes sense. And also, I do give him credit for the fact that he voluntarily, he didn't have to respond to any of that social media stuff. He was calling me and tracking me down and being very available to meet with me and trying to get me to meet with him. And that says a lot, because I feel like if he was involved, why the hell would he do that?
That's what I expect for somebody who is more or less being accused. You know, if people are saying, hey, JB had something to do with it, that's how I would act too. I'd be like, hey, let me tell you what went down for real.
You want it out there that you didn't do that. And this murder, just nothing indicates that it was drug related in the sense that it was about drugs. It was a crime of passion. One way or the other, it was a crime of passion. I think that they genuinely thought that Chris might have had something to do with it. And also perhaps the thought was, well, he's a bad guy. He deals drugs. He's on drugs. It was just really easy to sort of slot him into that and say, maybe he did it. And we really don't even know why he got accused of it. Well, I still don't understand why. I mean, and granted, the police aren't sharing evidence, so there could be evidence we don't know about. But I mean, I really have no idea why he was named as a suspect. It's even possible that when the police were doing their initial interviews, they heard the same rumors we're all hearing, you know? But it really is, it's terrible that their names are still getting texted. When I say, does anybody have any names? Some of the same names get texted to me. If it's proven they had nothing to do with it, think about that. Living in a community where everybody thinks you killed somebody or you had something to do with it, and your name is kind of getting brought up as being connected to this, and you had nothing to do with it. I mean, even if you did do drugs or something, that's a whole different thing than murdering someone.
I feel like it would be a huge weight lifted off this town's shoulders to have this thing finally put to rest.
So we have the murder weapon, a piano leg. And we know it took just a single blow to the head to kill Rebecca. We've tracked down the prime suspects and don't think they did it. Now we just have to find out who did. I'm Katherine Townsend, and this is Helen Gone. Is a joint production between How Stuff Works and School of Humans. It is written and recorded by me, Katherine Townsend. Taylor Church is our producer and story editor. Audio editing and design by Jonathan Sleeve. Mix engineer, Glenn Matullo. Audio mixing and love by Tune Welders. Executive producers Brandon Barr and Elsie Crowley for School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Chuck Bryant for How Stuff Works. Our field producer is James Morrison. Our researcher is Sandy Klosterman. Theme and original score by Ben Solee. Available wherever you get your music. To dig into the investigation, please visit HelenGonePodcast.com or follow us on social media.
School of Humans.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, This is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into the secret history of the casting couch, to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.